Okay.
So, good morning, good afternoon, hello. It's wonderful to see you. I recognize some of you and some of you are new, so warm welcome, a really warm welcome. First, I'll say that I'm Diana Clark. You can tell by my little name here in my little square box. And what a pleasure it is to be teaching with my good friends, David, Kim, and Ying. Before we opened it up to you guys, we were talking like, wow. How great it is that we get to teach together. I don't know, we've taught quite a few courses and classes together. So what a pleasure it is to be teaching with my good friends. And maybe I'll pass it on to, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to pass it on to David or Ying now. I don't remember for them to say good morning. Maybe you.
Ying.
Oh, there we go, Ying.
Well, I just extend my warm welcome. It's such a delightful thing to kind of explore Pali Canon together. I'm still amazed that when I began this journey, I felt like a lot of this all by myself. It's just today and seeing all of you and just having so much joy in my heart that we get to explore this together. And the four of us have been having so much fun with it and keep discovering new things together. So let this unfold in this next two classes.
Yeah, and I would just add, an additional warm welcome and echo. I think this already you can sort of hopefully sense this sense of camaraderie or companionship in the practice. The four of us have found exploration of texts from the Pali Canon to be a really wonderful part of the practice, and the sharing of it is just I think makes it additionally wonderful. And in the spirit of that, I want to make sure we extend a warm welcome to people who for whom this is the first time to participate in one of these classes. Sometimes we see familiar faces, but I really appreciate just that people come to join in this conversation with us. And sometimes that takes, a leap of faith or some time on a Saturday morning or just kind of leaning into it. And that's a wonderful thing too, to just celebrate that, leaning into something that's different, that's new, that may seem a little bit daunting, ancient texts from this mysterious Pali Canon. So yeah, welcome. Welcome.
Okay, well, I can only echo what all of my friends have said, and I'll just offer my welcome also. And then I always get the fun task, or often get the fun task, of doing an overview a little bit of the registration forms that came in. We do actually read all those things that you say. And so I wanted to mention that we have people here from four different countries and 21 US states. So, at least that was the registration. So there's a broad mix of people. And then, as far as what people wrote in their interests for taking the course, we had also a wide range. Some people want to get closer to the teachings of the historical Buddha. And, there's a sense of wanting to go to the source. And there could be various reasons for that. Some people are intellectually interested, some are emotionally attracted, some see it as a support for their spiritual path. All of those are welcome and respected. And then some people expressed a wish to be able to navigate the text on their own. We hear teachers all the time quoting from the Pali Canon, or we read modern Dharma books that have things about it, and we think, I'd like to read that for myself and really see. Now, of course, we're reading in English, not the original Pali, but we have really excellent translations available, and it is totally accessible now for us to go to the source ourselves. One person said specifically that going to the suttas themselves would be preferable to picking up this and that teaching from various teachers. So I think as teachers, we can all relate to how we sometimes sound like this and that teaching is what we offer in our Dharma talks. So yes, please do check out what we're saying. And some people, as David mentioned, said that they thought the Pali Canon was a little daunting because it's a bunch of big books. I remember someone asked me once, can you help me understand these big books? And the way they said it was clear that the bigness was a little challenging. So yeah, it's nice just to have there is a structure and an organization to them, and we'll go through that to make it a little bit clearer. And then some people saw textual study as part of their path, which we very much encourage seeing them that way. There are a lot of different ways to read the text. You can read them in only a scholarly sense, or looking for historical clues about how culture was at the time, many different ways. But one of the ways, and the one that we emphasize, is that you can read these texts as part of the spiritual path. How can we engage these ancient teachings for our modern spiritual development? How can that be done? So we'll talk about that a bit also. And then I've saved for last some of my favorite ones, which are people who just write love of Dharma on there. So it's like, if it's involved with the Dharma, I want to be there. That's great. So it's a nice mix. Our hope is to touch into the Pali Canon from a variety of angles. There will be some straight intellectual information that's helpful, we hope. There will be some emotional or devotional components. We're going to play a chant later today, for example. That's often how these texts have been carried through the centuries. There's going to be some pragmatic instructions for how to find these teachings within the Pali Canon, how to find a particular sutta. And there'll be a chance for you to discuss with each other your own views and how you think this relates to your particular practice. So I hope that for everyone, there will be maybe something familiar and something novel. And maybe we can each try to find something like that for each of us. And so maybe you'll try out several of these different ways that we're going to talk about the Pali Canon and maybe find something new that works well. All right, so I'll pass it on to Ying to give a bit more of an overview of the course.
Yeah, thank you, Kim. And thank you, Diana and David, for opening us up. And what I want to do maybe is to say a few words about kind of aims of those two classes that we'll be having over the two weekends, two Saturday mornings. And at first, I just want to say we called this class Entering the World of Pali Canon. It is really a world, a world of its own. So I invite maybe having an orientation as if you're entering into a whole new world. Some of you might have already been there for a while, but maybe bring some freshness in terms of engaging in this world. The world has a different language. And even after this gets translated into English, we know there are different translations. The world has its own culture. I think one of the things as we enter into this world, we'll discover through reading and listening to the text, we also get a sense of how people lived 2,000-something centuries ago and how they are receiving the teachings. And the teachings that passed down came from an oral tradition. And this may have evoked certain ways of orientation relating to the teachings that may be quite different from how we are reading it today, kind of reading books. And so kind of there are all these different dimensions that come along. For me, I often relate to this from my own limited experience. I remember realizing I'm not a native speaker, an English speaker. I at some point noticed how little emotional association I have with some of the words that are being said in English. and they all feel pretty flat. And then I look at the people around me, they seem to have just a huge emotional senses with it. But over time, I began to develop a certain kind of emotional cognizance with the language. And this may be true with the Pali Canon, even with the translations. They may feel flat, awkward, and kind of strange. But as we open ourselves up to it, over time, we may begin to really feel and sense how these teachings are alive in people's lives. And so it's inviting you to really kind of go into this world as you're a new explorer into a new culture, a new place altogether. And so then there's the two classes. We are going to cover some of the major aspects of this, the structure of the Pali Canon text, and the origination, and the history of this collection. So you realize the Pali Canon is evolving over time. And we'll also share some, in the second class, we'll share some practical tools for navigating this text. This is really good news, because I remember when we started some decades ago, there were no tools. So it's quite fascinating that we have so many tools available nowadays. And so we'll share some of this and to help us navigating and the text. We'll also offer some introductory words about the Pali language. And the language is a big part of the culture. And let's see what else I want to say here. The last but not the least is to encourage through this course, encourage exploration of how we relate to this text. I think as I was looking at the notes that we had, what we might say, we said that we are the Dharma teachers presenting this as a relevant practicing the path. And there is a role for studying and learning and getting to know certain knowledges it's presented in the text. And yet it's more important for us to find ways through learning and studying the text that enrich our practice and that allows our heart and mind to become more and more free. And so that's our wish through this studying and practicing series, including this exploration that will unfold in the next two classes. So with that, I'm going to pass it down to, was it David? Yeah.
Thank you, Ying. Yeah, nice brief orientation to the class. So we'd like to begin or continue with a breakout group, and just because I think we want to emphasize a little bit the beauty, not the importance or the utility so much of doing this practice together in community, but just the loveliness of it as we found it. And we thought it would be good to connect people sort of at the beginning. And so we're just going to give sort of two kind of overarching questions for breakout room discussion about maybe 10 or 12 minutes in kind of conversation. Those questions are, what is your inspiration for taking the class? Just sharing sort of what brings you to a class on this rather obscure topic on a Saturday morning. And whether you have any sort of burning question, you know, something that really, some specific interest that motivates, you know, your interest in the class. And I think everybody here is probably pretty familiar with breakout room discussion. We would just emphasize sort of, again, the sort of what can be learned from one another. So making it this an exercise in listening and wise speech, and learning from one another about motivations, intentions, the things that bring us to practice and to this particular class. And we will suggest maybe going around in a circle and just dropping in one thing at a time. No reason to say everything on these two questions with each response, but just kind of dropping things in as you go around a circle, about three or four people in each group. And maybe sometimes things start slowly. We can suggest just beginning with the first, alphabetical order, the traditional alphabetical order of that comes up in with the first name of people or the first identifying letter of people's screen names. So with that, enjoy one another's company. And what is your inspiration for coming here today? And sort of any burning questions, anything that's really something you want to know at the end of the class. Okay, we'll check back in with you in 10 to 12 minutes. I like it when people come back with smiles, just because causes me to smile too. Nice to see. So why don't we just debrief briefly? We would love, it's very useful for us to get a sense of what interests, what motivations bring you to this class. It helps us sort of meet them to the extent we can. What came up in your groups that would be wonderful to share? Francisca.
Hi. Hi. I'm here for the second time to get deeper on the understanding of the structure and the places and the different, especially the different translations available and the meaning that is different because this word was used here, but the other translator used the other word, and how that can benefit us from reading more than one instead of only one. So yeah. that was the last part of our group where we discussed that most.
Nice. Thank you for mentioning that, Francisca. That's so important, actually, that one of the things that this kind of study and bringing this kind of study into practice allows us to do is craft our own vocabulary of practice, kind of develop a language of practice that supports our practice. Some of that can be the Pali, some of that can be different English or other, language renderings of the Pali. So yeah, thanks for that, for bringing that in. I think that's going to be something we'll continue to explore together. Other reflections from the group, other things that come up that people would like to share? Anything else bring people to the class that would be good to know? Hi, Stuart and Mariella.
Hi.
Hello.
Good to see you.
One of my main motivations was to feel part of the Sangha, which, sit with Gil every weekday. And it's great, the connection with people. But being here live with a different group of people, and then in the breakout room meeting someone that I've known for years for the first time. And nice. The whole thing was really, really nice. You get a real appreciation of Sangha.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Thank you for saying that. A wonderful community practice. Your mention of Gil is useful too, because many people here have some, maybe quite a lot of, knowledge of Gil and his teachings. And Gil does this. He draws on these texts. He makes reference to the languages, and he makes reference, as Francisca pointed out, is so important to, varying translations and ways to render them. Gil, as a translator, has translated many of these things differently over his career as a translator, over his translating history. So anyway, I think that's a nice note. We all, many of us anyway, have shared that, you know, some inspiration that comes from Gill's approach to these very same texts. So Aaron.
Yes, something that came up, that actually came up from myself, is how do I know what the Buddha said in the Pali Canon? Because, you know, after he passed away, then, somebody else took over. And of course, nothing was written down until, 400 years later in Sri Lanka? So we've got a lot of things out there that, maybe from his disciples, but I'd kind of like to know if there's a way to know more, maybe it's not possible, about how I can recognize actually what the Buddha was teaching.
Yeah. Thanks for introducing that. I wouldn't be surprised if many people have that question. We didn't actually kind of say that as one of the, things that comes in, but I think we all share this question, how much of what we read can we really attribute to the Buddha? And Diana is going to answer that question in the very last minutes of next Saturday. So stay tuned. No, I'm kidding. There is no answer to that question that we can know for sure. And you'll notice that careful scholars and practitioners and teachers, Gill and ourselves among them, will frequently say things when we're being careful, like the Buddha is quoted in this text as saying. And this is a way of acknowledging that, we don't know if this is a verbatim quote from the Buddha and that can't be known. But we'll continue to explore that. But I'm glad you brought that in, because I think that, that'll be something that we'll continue to address as we go forward.
That maybe I could just add something to that.
Yeah, yeah, go for it.
In that the great thing about these Buddhist texts is they continually point us toward verification in our own experience. So in a sense, we don't know that the Buddha, exactly that person, said these things, but the texts are pointing toward a result of less suffering. And so we can always check for ourselves, does putting this into practice have that impact on my mind? And in a sense, that might be good enough.
Yeah, thanks, Kim. And, I don't know why I was answering all the questions or coming up with things. Diana Ying, do you have things to offer for any of these comments so far? My apologies. Did you shake your heads? And now I don't know whether nodding or shaking. Okay, jump in if you want to, please. Yeah, thanks, Kim. And one further thing is just, the texts point to such human exchange. Maybe we don't know if these are the voices of the people named, but that this is a recognizable human exchange that can feel very immediate and real. Debbie,
thank you all. I think this is my fourth class I've got to explore with the dream team. I call you. I'm a new practitioner. Well, since Gil started his mornings, and it's so wonderful to see friends that I just see names every morning. And Gil would always mention the Pali, and I shared this with my group, but I bought this book 2 years ago so I could, and I couldn't do it on my own. So I just really am grateful for the exploration in a group. And Gauri, who is in my group, who I've met through many classes, we're teachers. I was a teacher for decades. And to learn things together is the best. I find that has meaningful impact. So thank you. And I'm looking forward to seeing all this. So I'm so delighted to be back.
Thank you. Thank you, Debbie. And great. Good to have you. And just for everyone, Debbie held up a book that's called In the Buddha's Words, which is brings together many texts from the Pali Canon, the Sutta text of the Pali Canon. And maybe Debbie could drop the citation in the chat for us all. Some of you may recognize it, but yeah, I think we have time maybe for one more thing.
Then maybe, David, can I, before Susan, I just want to add one little thing. I want to concur with Debbie just said, because Kim, Ying, David, and I, we kind of became friends by studying the canon together and other literature together. We just noticed, recognized in each other that we shared this kind of wish to understand better, and then we became friends from this. So just recognizing what you're pointing to, Debbie, kind of learning together helps create community. So just want to throw that in there. Now we'll go to Susan.
Yeah, that was beautiful. And we wanted to say that. So Diana, I'm glad you found the spot. That's good. Yeah, Susan.
Hi. I just want to start off and say I appreciate IMC and Sati Center so much. Young Kuei actually messaged me and said, did you move to California? She only sees me in California things. I'm in Massachusetts, but... yeah, I actually just got off a retreat at IMS with Bhikkhunis, and we were reading the Tariqatha and discussing the, you know, the reimagining book and that whole snafu. And it was really what I took away from that, just the importance of preserving the original text. And it's great to come off that and now kind of go deeper in this way.
Great. Yeah. No, that's inspiring. Good. We'll talk about in texts that come in, that find a place in the, including the text that Susan just mentioned. I wanted to kind of demystify as we go. And yeah, these are, you know, people have made mentions of things. If they're not familiar, don't worry. We're going to kind of give a sense of how they fit in. And to kind of move in that direction, I'm going to turn it over to Diana.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So now I'd like to jump in a little bit, talking about the organization of the Pali Canon, and I'll do that by first. I'm going to be sharing my screen, so I'll be sharing some slides with you. For some of you, some of this will be old hat. You'll know this, but I'm hoping to sprinkle in some things that maybe are new, and for some of you, maybe it's new. So I'm going to build on the handouts that were sent to you before. If you looked at them, great. If you didn't look at them, that's perfectly fine. We're just going to work with that. So I'm going to share my screen. This gets a little complicated to do both have PowerPoint open and to be sharing. But hopefully you can see this, just this passage. I'm going to read this. In one whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. On whatever occasion the mind becomes concentrated in a bhikkhu whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, on that occasion the concentration enlightenment factor is aroused in one, and one develops it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. You might go, wait, what? Like, seems like there's good words in here: tranquility, pleasure, mind, concentration, enlightenment, fulfillment, like all kinds of good stuff in here. The English is a little clunky. And you might want to, if you hear this or a teacher is pointing to it, you might want to look this up for yourself. Like, what is the context? What is, how can I understand what's really being pointed to if somehow you just come across this passage? So I'd like to unpack the Pali Canon a little bit so that we can look at this, but recognizing that there are all kinds of interesting passages, beautiful passages, right, that scholars and Dharma teachers use and reference. So I just put this one up as one that's something that we may want to explore. So introduction to the organization of the Pali Canon, where I kind of think, like, okay, I'm going to put on my nerd glasses and off we go, this kind of thing. Okay, so many of you know this, right? That the Pali Canon as a whole has these three baskets, Ti, Pitaka. The little T-I is for three. It's one of the rare Pali words that has a kind of a cognate in English. There's the Vinaya, which is the rules for the monastics, the Nikaya, which are the teachings, the suttas, the discourses, and the vast majority of the things we talk about, maybe 98% come from this basket, and then the Abhidhamma. So the Vinaya was transmitted by Upali, who was the barber at the time of the Buddha. So, and Kim will talk a little bit more about this, but when they were reciting the Pali Canon, the Upali. So in my imagination, all the monks, right, they have shaved heads. So they shave each other's heads. And in Upali is like the head barber, and they're practicing the rules because they have to recite them regularly. So Upali's there when everybody's shaving their head. This is a story that I made up, but maybe this is true. Maybe it actually happened. And then the Nikayas were transmitted by Ananda, the Buddha's assistant. This is what the tradition holds. And the Abhidhamma, it's not so clear. And Abhidhamma sometimes gets translated into English as like the higher teachings, Abhidhamma. But Abhi can also mean something that means concerning or about. So it could mean about the teachings. But if any of you have looked at it, it's highly systematized. Essentially, it's a bunch of lists. It's a list of lists of lists. So I'm going to unpack a little bit this middle one, the Nikayas. So there are five Nikayas, the Digha Nikaya, Majjhima, Samyutta, Anguttara, and Kutika. In English, we would call these the long discourses, the middle length, connected, numerical, and minor. So the long discourses, not surprisingly, are long. There's a lot of them. In this whole book, there's only 34 suttas. Middle length, there's 152. They're a little bit shorter. The book is like this, right? Perhaps many of you have seen this. And then there's a collection of shorter. They have long, middle, and then a bunch of short ones. And then the short ones are kind of divided between the Samyutta, which are the connected or linked. So what that means is that they have a particular topic that then they go into a little bit deeper. So for example, in the Samyutta, there'll be like dependent origination, and there'll be whole suttas all about dependent origination, or the five aggregates, a whole bunch of suttas just about the five aggregates, six sense bases, anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, for example. And Anguttara are the numerical discourses. And so these are things that are, some of it a repeat of what's in other places, but also like these interesting lists. And they're like a list of fives in the chapter of five. The fourth chapter have things that have four lists in them. And for example, Anguttara 5, 161, that means the 161st sutta in the chapter on the five, are the five ways of removing resentment, right? So it's, or the four kinds of people who do this, or three of this, eight of that. We don't see some of the most common teachings are not in the Anguttara, but it's all, some of them are, but not all of them. And there's a, instead just an emphasis on numerical lists. And then the Kutika, it's called the minor discourses. And it's like, I'll talk about a little bit more about that in a moment, but it's a list of smaller. I don't know if minor does it justice. I would say maybe smaller. So Bhikkhu Bodhi has an idea about why they are organized this way. The longer discourses were about the propagating Buddhism. These long discourses have really big narrative arcs. They're sometimes really interesting, compelling stories. So it's a way to draw people in. And it's also about distinguishing Buddhism from the other traditions at that time. So the Digha has a particular flavor. The Majjhima Nikaya is the one of the purposes is for new monastics. So it has some of the basic teachings, how to practice, what are some of the doctrinal points? And that's often why Dharma teachers quote from the Majjhima Nikaya the most, is because these teachings for the monastics also can be the teachings for us, some of the basic things. The Samyutta has deeper, once you have the basics of the teachings, the Samyutta goes more in depth. and that Anguttara can add some of the extra teachings, but also might be a way to support those who are teaching the suttas. Like, oh yeah, okay, there's four things that they need to know about this. What were those four? And you can go look it up in that four. So this is just a theory about why they are organized this particular way, is because they have different purposes. And one thing I'll say is, for those of us who have, you know, been poking around in the Pali Canon a lot, you could give us a sutta and we could probably tell you which book it's in from, because they each have their own flavor and length and topic. So once you become familiar, you can kind of guess from which book it's from. So I want to unpack a little bit about this last one, the Kudaka Nikaya. There are many books in the Kudaka Nikaya, and what I remember the most is John Peacock coming to IMC maybe 15 years ago, 10 years ago, I don't remember. And I was brand new to studying the Pali Canon. And he said, this has odds and sods. I don't know what that is, but it sounded kind of funny. So that's how I remember it. But there are many books in the Kudaka Nikaya. And interestingly, not all Theravada traditions agree on which books are in there. For example, like in the Burmese Theravada version, they include a book that the Thai don't include. So some versions of the Kudaka Nikaya are a little bit different. So the ones that I have here, Dhammapada, Udana, Ittivuttaka, Suttanapatta, Theragata, Therigata, these are generally considered to be the oldest, that is to be considered closest to the time of the Buddha. And then I just put here others. There's so many, the Parisamhita Magga, the Nidesa, Petavattu, Buddhavamsa, Appadana. Some of these you've probably never heard of. Appadana just got translated into English just a few years ago. They are definitely older. And you don't even have to understand Pali. If you were to read these in English, there is such a different feeling about them. But also, part of the way that scholars look at this is just in the exact same way when we hear English and we hear like Victorian English, we recognize, oh, this is old English. We probably know what it means, but we recognize just the use of the words and the grammar is a little bit different. In the same way, scholars do that with Pali. They can say, oh, this is a little bit older than newer, both by the grammar and the words that are being used. So, oh, and then I just put here, some of the things that we are familiar with come from the Kudaka Nikaya, the Metta Sutta, the Book of Eights that Gil translated is here in the Suttanapatta, and the Bahiya Sutta comes out of the Udana. So that quote that I read at the beginning is from the Anapanasati, and and it's in the Majjhima. I was trying to move the Zoom picture out of the way so I can see the slide here, but right, so the Majjhima is one of the Nikayas, and then there's Majjhima 118, and then that one in particular is the 35th section in the Anapanasati. This is pretty straightforward. You just, 118 is after 117, before 119. It's not too hard to find, but that's not the way that it is in Pali. The way the original organization was is that first, the Nikaya is separated into groups of 50. Then each group of 50 is grouped into five chapters of 10. And then each chapter has 10 suttas. So in the Pali, the Anapanasati Sutta is the eighth sutta in the second chapter of the final 50. So they didn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 152. This is a modern nomenclature. And this next week, we'll unpack this, what the implications are that they're organized this way. So if you're just going to do things in English, you don't really need to worry about this, except when this will become more clear maybe next Saturday when we talk about this. So then, I just also want to mention, I've been talking about Majjhima Nikaya 118.35, but there's also the numbering of the Pali. And so maybe I'll go down to this bullet here. So Majjhima 118.35, that's the English, but sometimes we see it in the Pali, and we'll see something like this, M, then a Roman numeral, and then a number. And this means page 86 of the third volume of the Majjhima Nikaya. That's in the Pali Roman script. And this will make more sense in a moment when Kim talks later about how we got from palm leaves to paper and to different scripts into Roman script. But just often you'll see suttas that have two different numbers or one or the other. If it's a Roman numeral, they're talking to the Pali. If it's just a regular number, they're talking about English. So that's the way you can tell the difference. And sometimes it can be frustrating to find this. And next week we'll talk a little bit about how you can go back and forth. And then I'll just point out another little interesting thing or something that can kind of trip us up about the numbering. Some of the things in the Kudaka Nikaya are by verse number or sutta number. Earlier, somebody talked about the Terigata verses. And sometimes Padachara, for example, for those of you who have been hanging around IMC, you know that we have the statue of Padachara, and there's been a number of Dharma talks. We talk about Padachara. So her verses are in the Terigata, which is in the Kudaka Nikaya. But there's two different ways you could talk about her verses. You could say it's the 10th sutta on the Book of Fives, Terigata 5:10, or their verses number 112 through 116. And different translators do different ways of the nomenclature here. So sometimes it's tricky. I know myself that I've been trying to look something up, and I have one and I need the other and trying to figure that out. But just a heads up about this, about all these verses that are in the Kudaka Nikaya, there's often two different ways in which the numbering is. And then I'm just going to end with this last little tidbit, pronunciation hints. That Pali doesn't have TH as in the word the. Instead, it's like the word Thomas. And PH is like, it's not like F, but instead it's like the word upholstery. The long A is like father, fa, and then the short A is in as in cut. So there's, you know, nobody's going to grade us on our pronunciation, but just in case you're kind of worried that, or thinking about this, there's the Thomas, upholstery, father, cut. Okay, that's my end. And now I'll pass it on to Ying.
Wow, thank you. Thank you, Diana, for that. I don't know, I'm just feeling so happy seeing this and getting little pieces of new things that I didn't realize. I found of this Abhidhamma translated as a higher or about. Just feel the difference, right? And it's interesting. So we have a little time for us to ask any questions about what's being offered so far or anything at this point. So, yeah, Francisca.
There's a book that I understand is very widely read, and also Gil Fronsal translated it. And it's named the Dhammapada. Is that part of the Pali Canon? Isn't it? Where is it? If it is, that's something I've never found out.
Yeah,
Thank you.
So I wonder if Diana wants to show that slide again. And I can. It's actually in the first one in the minor collection. If Diana can pull that slide out. Diana, would you like to just say?
Here I have to unmute myself here. I think, is it here? Nope.
The next one, I believe.
Here we go. Here's the Dhammapada. So it's in the Kutaka Nikaya. The Kutaka Nikaya, or maybe Francisca, I can see that you're looking at, does this make sense? So the Dhammapada is here. It's in the Kutaka, and then the Kutaka is, you know, over here, siblings with these other books. So that's where the Dhammapada is. And maybe I'll say the Dhammapada is the most translated text of all of early Buddhism. There's a lot of those. So
yeah, many, many translations. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Will?
Yeah, I find it interesting, you know, in the wisdom series of the translations, you have one translation for the Majjhima and one for the Anaguttara, but the Kutaka, it's like a bunch of different books, not all one.
That's right. You
know, one volume.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. They're actually, I think if the Kutaka and Nikaya were to be together, it would be so big. Probably the biggest, because it's a collection of so many. And like I said, some of them haven't even been, they were just translated like 2 years ago, like the Upadana. And yeah, if you were to look at it, you would understand like, oh, these teachings, there aren't doctrinal teachings in them. There aren't as much interest for translators. The translators are more interested in what's related to practice or the teachings.
Yeah. In that collection, just a Sutta Nipika is huge. So if you look at the books, then you'll see, wow, that's in there too. Okay, Susan.
This is all very new to me. It's the first time I've had an overall picture, and I'm fascinated, and it's all going by quickly. I wonder if you would be willing to share those slides with us.
Yes, they will be sent out after the class. So you will have them, and we will have them too. Yes, yeah. Thank you, Neha.
Hi. Thank you. So I was wondering, Diana, you spoke of how each of the discourses, right, the Majjhima or the Digha, or each of them sort of have a purpose, or you know, the middle end discourses are more for people who are maybe the new monastics. What did you say about the last two? I missed that, which is the Anguttara and the Kutaka.
I'm happy to answer, but I'm also happy, Kim, I know that, do you want to say anything here or David?
Yeah. Well, my understanding is that the Samyutta is also for monastics, but maybe for those who are not so beginner and who are kind of directing themselves toward awakening, and they really need the deeper structural material and the teachings that point straight that direction. And then the Anguttara is more for, could be for teachers to give Dharma talks. That one I have a little question about. There may be other reasons.
Yeah, maybe I'll just say that as you read or listen to this text, open to how you receive them. Because when I started reading Samyutta Nikaya first, there is such timelessness with reading that. But when you begin to open to Digha and Majjhima, there's all of a sudden a totally different flavor. It's like you're living in a whole new world reading them. And so all these different collections may evoke a different sense in you. And so it's all for us to explore as well. Yeah. Amy.
Hey, hello. I was wondering why the Dhammapada would be the most translated of all of these books.
Okay. Any of my co-teachers who would like to answer this?
Maybe I'll jump in. It's all in verse, and some of it is pithy. So really short little teachings. that, you know, people can remember and like to do, I'll say that. Then maybe I'll say something also about translating verse and from Pali to English. Just the exact same way we do in English, sometimes with poetry, we use words that are not so common. We use sentence structure that is not so common to make it sound poetic. In the same way, Pali does that too. And but in addition, the Pali is done with a particular meter, like I don't know exactly what the meter, but you know, the third syllable has to be long and the second syllable has to be shorter, you know, something like this. So the Pali in verse is different than the Pali in prose. The Pali in verse really takes, is not in the usual way, and it's not often the usual form or common words. So if you're a translator, this is either fantastic because you get to interpret it however you think is the best, or it's really frustrating if you're trying to get it precise. So a lot of translators like to do verse because it allows for a little bit more interpretation. Not all translators. I know some translators really don't like to do verse at all because it's so difficult. But that's my interpretation. Maybe some of my colleagues have some other ideas.
You know, I would just add two things. One, oh, it's really beautiful. That was the first thing that came to mind. But the other thing is that certain texts become popular. And, you know, our practice is influenced by a small number of texts. One of the beauties of this class, I think, is to open the door to, you know, this huge variety of things that are available, from the verses of monastics as they experienced awakening, to the Dhammapada, to rare jewels, you know, and as Kim mentioned, in the Samyutta, these detailed things, or even the Abhidharma, which gets a bad name, you know, each of these all has something to offer for our practice. And we shouldn't be, I think, too influenced by those that have become popular over time and that everybody reads, you know, those are great, but there's so much more.
Okay, the last one, Aaron.
Yes, I've just been reading a bit about the Dhammapada, and my understanding is it derives from the Dhammapada commentary. Do you have any words to that effect? That's and that the Dhammapada itself is just taken little bits of that Dhammapada commentary and made them into these wise reflections, I guess I could call them.
I'm curious. Any of my co-teachers want to say?
Yeah, I would disagree with that. I don't know how to say this nicely, but in terms of, and Kim will talk about this in a little bit later, the commentaries are much later. They're, I don't know, 800 years later or so. And they provide the backstory for each one of the verses. So, but there is, I mean, in the canon, the Dhammapada is very succinct. It's very clear what is the actual verses. So it is different than the commentary. And then maybe I'll say the commentaries can be fun to read for the Dhammapada because the backstories have these incredible, like fantastical, like, well, this was said on the occasion of this person had, I don't know, some dramatic thing. And that, and whether that's true or not, of course, we don't know. But I would say there's very clear distinction between the Dhammapada and the commentary in the canon. The canon only contains the Dhammapada, and Kim will talk about this, the commentary is later. I don't know, is that helpful, Aaron?
Yes, it is. There's a specific book I'm referring to as Buddhist Legends. I can't remember the guy's name. He lived back in, I think he was in like 1920. He wrote this whole thing about, I think it was about the Dhammapada, and the commentaries. So I started reading his book, and it is, yeah, it's a lot of stories which actually originated back in those times, like stories about an elephant or a tiger, you know, all kinds of stories that seem to give kind of a flavor for the time. And I find them somewhat interesting. From that perspective.
Yeah, Diana, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe I'll just say, so within the Theravada tradition, there are some schools within Theravada who are definitely, I don't know, read the commentaries or influenced by the commentaries, definitely hold the commentaries as kind of like really important. There are other traditions in Theravada which don't hold the commentaries with the same authority as what's in the canon. And I am from, I've kind of inherited where I make a distinction between what's in the canon and what's in the commentaries. But not all Theravada practitioners, not all Theravada lineages do that. And so, and I think that's, I love some of the stories. I think they're inspiring and beautiful and fun. Some of them are fun too, but in my, what I've inherited, make a distinction between them. But I want to honor and respect that that's not all traditions do that. And I don't know, does any of my colleagues want to say anything about this?
Yeah, I'll just say maybe for things like a Dhammapada, it's really nice to read it with the different frames. So, and, you know, sometimes it's very fun to read the stories and the backstories of it. And other times, just dropping a verse in meditation or dropping a verse for a day to start a day. And recently I've been reading the verses on happiness. Oh, just bring that in. Enriches how we relate to Dharma in different ways. And especially at Dhammapada, they're really just, you know, very small verses. And bring that in our lives. I'm conscious we are at the break, so we'll offer a 5 minutes, maybe a bio break, and then we'll come back together in 9:45. Thank you.
And next, we would like to sit in meditation together briefly. And so I'm looking around and seeing people coming back. So, yeah, as you come back, maybe you can sort of start to settle into meditation by taking advantage of the motion that's underway, coming back to sitting, and sort of settling into a feeling of arriving. Coming here, being here now, as we like to say, a sense of coming back to center. And because they were offered to us earlier, I'll just guide a little meditation that incorporates the passage that Diana shared. The passages we find in the suttas, in the canon, can in various ways guide our practice. And one way that many of them do is by suggesting ways to drop instructions or descriptions of meditative practice into the meditation itself. So we can read about it, but we can also do it. We can also use the passages that are offered to us as a way to structure our meditation, give our meditation light, inspire our practice. So I see before me a group of experienced meditators. I'm going to then also join you, closing my eyes, invite you to close your eyes. And as with the closing of the eyes, like returning to your seat in front of the Zoom screen, maybe rebalancing attention inward, bringing our attention inward, downward, bringing attention to the inner world, our inner life, bringing our attention into the body. Bringing attention first, maybe to the posture, and the balance of the body, the balance of the torso over the waist, the balance of the head over the shoulders, and just settling into a meditative posture that balances us, reflects the balance that we adopt for the meditation between alertness, presence, curiosity, and ease. A posture of both mind and body, of mind, body, heart, that reflect an alert relaxation or a relaxed alertness. And then we can bring our attention to the breathing happening, connecting with the breath in the body, feeling the breath moving the abdomen, feeling the sensations of breathing at the chest, the solar plexus, lifting the shoulders slightly, the shoulders softening with each out-breath. Maybe connecting with the breath in the nose, just noticing the breath coming in cool and quick and coming out with each exhalation a little warmer, a little softer, a little slower after contact with the body. Maybe we can touch in with that although we sit alone in our practice today, we're joined by 36 other practitioners. And that in this community of practice, there's great goodwill. There's support for one another's practice. Maybe we can feel the support of others for our own practice, and maybe we can open the heart slightly to provide support for others that are here. And share a little bit of the benefit of our meditation with our fellows. And then we can bring the passage that Diana offered earlier into this meditative space, these meditative surroundings, this meditative home. And touching in with any tranquility that's there in our experience. The body at ease, maybe, even if there's discomfort or unpleasant. Maybe there's some tranquility that's just an aspect of the meditation. And we can just appreciate that, notice that. We can touch in with any pleasure that's available in the meditation. The practice invites us to recognize pleasures of mind and body in the meditation that come from the seclusion, from our surroundings that are related to the connection to the here and now of our experience. And the passage invites us to notice this, that when we bring attention to this tranquility or to the pleasures of meditation, that the mind too can find itself more collected, more still, sometimes more open, brighter, more at ease. And in this soft touch of attention that we bring to these aspects of our experience, we are cultivating peace. with the touch of mindful attention to our own experience, showing up for it as it is, noticing wholesome experience in it. Thus the path is cultivated, thus the path is walked.
Thank you, David. That was lovely. So just bringing ourselves back into the world of the computer. And so I'd like to speak a little bit now. The theme for today is kind of the big picture. And Diana gave a wonderful overview of the structure of the Pali Canon as we have it now. And as you might suspect, these texts have a history, and they also have a relationship to other Buddhist texts. There's more to Buddhist scripture than the Pali Canon. So we definitely can't go over all of that, but I would like to offer now some comments on the history and the preservation and the transmission of the Pali texts. And the purpose is to, you know, to give us some context for this, for the Pali Canon. So the historical Buddha lived during the 5th century before the Common Era, and he died around 400 BCE. And the teachings were not written down at that point. But that actually isn't strange. In India at that time, there was a strong tradition of oral transmission of religious teachings. It was already being done by the Brahmins, the historical religious class of the time. And so it was normal that teachings were memorized and recited and spoken, and that was how they were communicated. But soon after the Buddha's death, his parinibbana, there was what's called a council, the first council, And it was a meeting of the Arahant disciples of the Buddha to recite the suttas and the Vinaya and to generally agree on what these teachings were. So as Diana mentioned, Upali was the reciter of the Vinaya, the barber, and Ananda was the reciter of the suttas. And the Abhidhamma came a little later. And there were a series of these councils over the years. Especially they would happen when there were disputes arising over doctrinal or Vinaya issues. As you can imagine, there wasn't always agreement about what it was that the Buddha said. We've already had questions about that. And sometimes there were actually splits into different schools. We don't have just a single transmission line of the teachings. But what is now called the Theravada school, the Asian antecedent of what we're doing here in the West, the Theravada school, does trace its roots all the way back to this original period just after the Buddha. And so I'll show a diagram of some of this a little bit later. But lest you think that these councils were just a thing of the past, the Sixth Burmese Council was held in Myanmar, in Burma, in 1954. And it included 2,500 monks from 8 different countries. And the edition of the Pali Canon that was agreed upon and approved at this council can be found online. We now have different transmission methods. And it's also the Pali version that is found on Sutta Central, which we're going to talk about in our next class on May 7th. We'll talk about finding suttas, learning how to navigate Sutta Central. And on there, you can find Pali versions of the suttas. And that's what the Pali versions are. They're the ones that were agreed upon at the Sixth Burmese Council. So then we might have the question, well, when did the teachings get written down? Where was that transition point? So they were exclusively oral at first, and then they got written down. But actually, the oral tradition continued in some form all the way to the present. It's not like it stopped at that point. But we do have this written version. So most likely, the Pali Canon was first recorded in Pali during the first century BCE. So several hundred years after the death of the Buddha. And scholars believe that was done because there was a sense of threat to the continuance of the teachings. There was some social unrest at that time. There was some religious persecution of Buddhists at that time. And there may have also been even difficult physical conditions like a famine going on. And so there was genuine concern that there might not be enough monks alive to know who would know each portion of the teachings. It would be a problem if all the monks who knew a certain book, like all the ones who knew the Dhammapada, died. It would be lost. And so someone said, "Hey, let's write these down." And so they were. But actually, first I'm going to show a little diagram to give us a sense of this timing. I've been talking about historical time. Let me see if I can share that. Okay. No, not that one. Hang on. There. Okay. So you can see then that the Buddha is way over at the farthest to the left. And then we have the Pali Canon and also these Chinese translations of it, or Chinese translations of the Sanskrit version of it. We won't get into the complications, but there's another set of texts called the Agamas that are similar to the canon, the Nikayas. And then the commentaries come much later. We had a little bit of a conversation about that earlier, but today we're far over on the right side of this diagram. So you can kind of get a roughly proportional sense of the elapsed time. I mean, things are a little bit variable because the commentaries were written over several hundred years. And we definitely don't have time to talk about the commentaries in this class, but I just wanted to show because you'll hear these words, you'll hear these names, the canon, the commentaries, etc. So I hope that's somewhat helpful. Okay. So then we can talk about these written teachings. They were first written down on banana leaves. And that's not the most durable medium, but that's where they were first written down. The three baskets, I believe, are referred to baskets of leaves, you know, put it in with the right basket, where the teachings go. So the piles were kept in these three baskets. And later people, of course, used other things like paper. And, you know, now we have them on the computer. And so they continue to change over time. We're trying to be flexible here with these teachings. But it is also true that this leaf tradition continues now. At the end of when I'm done talking, David is going to show you a real actual palm leaf manuscript. It's not of the Pali Canon itself, but it has some suttas in it. And they were, it's from Laos, from maybe a couple hundred years ago. And right there on palm leaves. So hang on for that. You'll see it in a moment. And I guess Diana mentioned a little bit about the script also, and maybe that's just worth saying, is that Pali, the language Pali, it's related to Sanskrit. It's an ancient Indian language. It doesn't have its own script, actually. So you write Pali in whatever script you already know from writing. So we have Roman script in the books that Diana was holding up. That's Pali translated into Roman script and then translated into English, of course. But you can also write Pali in Laotian script, as David is going to show, or Thai script or Burmese script, just whatever alphabet is, you can write the Pali sounds in that. So that's sometimes interesting to know. People say, oh, what is the script for Pali? It's anything. So the versions that we have in Roman script are fully authentic. You know, that's the Pali. There isn't any more original form. Okay, so was that first written version of the Pali Canon exactly what we have now? Probably not. That would be unlikely. But nonetheless, these texts have been lovingly preserved by sincere practitioners for a long time. And so that gives me some confidence in their transmission over time. And there are people who just their lives were dedicated to preserving these texts. And I love that we have the original, something like the Pali versions, so that each time we translate into some other language, we had a question earlier about translation. We have English versions, we have Spanish versions, many other languages. You'll see that also when we do Sutta Central. We have translations into a lot of languages. At least we have translate from one thing. And it's not that we're translating a translation of a translation that's been through a game of telephone over time. At least hopefully we've minimized that by the method of transmission that's been used. You know, we're also invited to verify for ourselves, as we said in the answer to the question earlier. You know, we can also check these teachings are aimed at certain elimination of suffering. They also describe particular meditative states that can be come to through practice. And we can check, does that actually happen in our own practice? We don't have to, in the end, believe something. We can check for ourselves and see if it is leading toward, you know, maybe someday we can even verify that what the Buddha talked about as awakening is true and correct. That's the inspiration for trying this out for ourselves. Also, I need to add a little caveat here, which is that because this class is on the Pali Canon and this set of texts, that's what we're talking about, it can give the impression that Buddhism is a religion of the book, the way, say, the Protestant religions are. Very centered around the Bible, and that it takes maybe the orthodoxy of Buddhism as the highest, you know, the doctrinal teachings, and that wouldn't be quite true. Buddhism is more of what's called an orthopraxy than an orthodoxy. So we talk about practicing in the correct way or practicing in ways that alter the mind, lead to transformation of our understanding and our way of living. And there can be many ways of doing that. And it's, so that's what maybe, not that we haven't had many, many arguments over the years about doctrine, that's very true. But in the end, hopefully we can connect over the practices. And so that's partly why David led us in that lovely meditation on some of the texts in MN 118, that we're meant to practice these things. So then finally, I want to show a very simplified chart of the expansion of Buddhism over time. Very, very simplified. And before I show it, I want to make a huge important caveat statement, which is that what the chart shows, in fact, I want to tell you how to interpret the chart. Buddhism is a living tradition that has changed over time. It's been changing since the moment the Buddha died. And rather than making a search for the true, authentic, real Buddhism, and rather than getting dogmatic or rigid, I think we can recognize that fixed views about Buddhism are not so helpful. So with that, let me show you this chart. So first we have this top part, simplified depiction of the expansion of Buddhism. So it starts with the Buddha, who died, as I said, around 400 BCE. And then here's the whole chart. Have we lost it? Hang on. Are you seeing that chart? No. Okay. Stop share. Hang on. Okay.
Kim, when you scroll, there we go.
I'm trying to get to the next page where I have more of it. There it is. Can you see that? Okay, so the death of the Buddha, 400 BCE. Now we have this. There is a thing, see if I can change the size of this. Yes, so we can see it all on one page. So the scholars call this a schism about 100 years after the death of the Buddha, and we have this division into the Shtabiravada and the Mahasanghika. And these multiple arrows on the, we're focused here on the left side, Theravada, Southern Buddhism. That's where we have the Pali Canon. That's where it's taken as authoritative. There were many different schools through this time, but the Theravada is kind of the one that survived. And there were, you know, maybe a couple dozen others in between. On the Mahasanghika, the right side, that's what eventually became Mahayana, Northern Buddhism. And there are many different versions of that. And I, like I said, this is really simplified, but I hope it just gives you a general impression, because sometimes in our modern world where we have access to so many different schools, teachings, teachers, people can be very confused and they combine things. You know, they mix up various different things. And it's not that we need to be rigid and dogmatic, because the schools are changing, as I said, but I do think it's important to know broadly where you are in that realm, and to not mix up the teachings. It's honorable and respectful to each school to allow it its own thing. And we're in the Theravada school that honors the Pali Canon, and that's different from the Mahayana tradition, for example. Okay, so with that, I've gone a little over, but I'm going to pass it on to David to show us this beautiful manuscript and then to open it up for questions after that.
Thank you, Kim. Yeah. I'll just share this scroll, which came in a way to the four of us as we taught these classes. This was found at a garage sale in Oregon, having made its way there probably from a monastery in Thailand or Burma. And it looks like this. I'm going to show it by hand, and then I'll show some pictures of it, share screen, because it's hard to see. But just to give you a sense of the size of it, this is a series of thin palm leaves that are spread together. I'll get some light on it. And again, you'll see better details in a moment, but it's quite fragile. But assumably, this would have been carried around by a monastic visiting, probably lay people, and used to refresh memory. We haven't really looked carefully into which suttas might be in here, We do know that when I first showed it to a friend of a friend to identify it, they recognized the Thai Lao script and also the sutta that I just happened to open it up to, the Mangala Sutta, which Kim gave a class about the other night. So let me show you some better, easier to see pictures by sharing screen, and then we'll go to questions. This is sort of a picture of the whole thing I just held up in with much better lighting. You can see that basically these letters, or characters are etched. That is, they're cut into the palm leaf, and then ash is spread over it and then shaken off, and the ash remains in the letter. So there's actually there's a physical etching. These are like plates. Just show you a couple more real quick of more detailed. Here's a picture of some of the lovely script. In this document, there are apparently several scribes at work. Here's another one with another completely different hand. So anyway, it's wonderful in a way to just have this direct contact with one way that these texts and these teachings were kept and carried and shared transmitted from warm hand to warm hand. After the questions, just in case you were thinking of running off, Kim's going to kind of show us yet another way that is one of the principal ways that they were communicated and remembered and passed on, which is by chanting. So there's an intersection of oral and textual transmissions of the teachings by way of text and language. That's, as she pointed out, very alive, very, very much something that continues at present as we practice and share what we learn from the practice. So yeah, we'd like to open it up for more questions about anything that's come up so far. Technical questions, I'm going to immediately pass on to Kim and Diana and Ying. But yeah, what's coming up for people? Yankui.
Yes. Thank you, everybody. And I'm sorry, I think I spaced out when I think it was Diana or somebody talking about Pali and how it can be in different languages. Is that Pali is oral, as an oral language? Is that what you meant? And then, like, so for example, what you just show, what is that written in? Was that written in Thai or in some? So anyway, I just want to clarify that. I'm a little confused about, and Sanskrit is a written language, I think, and spoken, but Pali is only a spoken, but I'm not sure. Okay, thank you.
I have a thought on that, but let me pass it back to Diana.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll just say
Kim.
That
there's Kim. Yeah.
What you were showing, what David was showing on the palm leaves. So the language is Pali. The script characters are a form of Thai Lao. I don't know what that means. Maybe that's near the border, something like that. Yeah. So that means that somebody who had gone to school in that language and was used to reading, they couldn't read those scripts because they're in Pali. You know, it would look as if we had opened, you know, the Pali canon in Pali, even if it's in the Roman script, we can't read Pali necessarily. So does that make sense? There's a difference between the script and the language.
Yeah. And earlier when Diana spoke of Roman script, that's Pali using Roman letters that, you know, are familiar in the languages of Europe.
Let me give a different example then. Yeah. Actually, because of course Chinese, they're the same, right? The we have characters are the same as the language. But the Roman script, which English is written in, you can also write German, French, Spanish. They all use the Roman script. And as a, you know, if I don't know French, for example, so if I see French, I can recognize the letters, but I can't read the words. So there's a difference between the script and the language. Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate that last bit. So tell me again, then Pali is the.
So Pali is the language,
language.
And it doesn't have its own script associated with it, you know, and so, you know, just like European languages don't have just one. They all share the same Roman script. So Pali can be written in any script. And so when we write it in the Roman script and it looks like English letters, that's perfectly authentic, but it could also be written in, you know, Lao, Burmese, any of the languages of South Asia.
Yeah. But you don't say that's a spoken language then. You don't say Pali is a spoken, it's still...
It has a pronunciation for each of the letters. So yes, it can be spoken.
Okay. And maybe
I'll... Go ahead, Diana.
I'll just add a little bit. Maybe a synonym we'd use for script would be alphabet. So there's different alphabets. It could be the Thai alphabet or the Burmese alphabet. And that's why when you see things in the Roman alphabet, the one that we usually write, that we write English in, sometimes you see there's a dot over the N or there's a bar over the A. That's because we're trying to mimic a sound that's not exactly in the Roman alphabet, but it approximates it. So that's what the dots and the bars are doing there, trying to change our alphabet a little bit to mimic the pronunciation of Pali. Andrea wrote on, is the Sanskrit alphabet used for Pali ever? I sense, Kim, do you know the answer to this? Because the Sanskrit that I know is in Devanagari or in Roman, but I don't, is there a Sanskrit alphabet?
I don't know. I've only seen it written in other, yeah.
Now, I think Sanskrit, too, can be rendered in various...
Yeah. What we're coming up against is that, you know, there wasn't a lot of written texts in ancient South Asia, 2,500 years before the Common Era. This was a time when, written languages were still coming into being and being used for things. You see the same thing in Europe, like in Egypt, and scripts were probably invented at different times in different places in the world. There wasn't just one invention of it, but this was all around the time when that was coming into being. And so, a lot of stuff just wasn't written. It's hard for us to imagine as moderns.
And I would just point out one other sort of interesting implication of Yankui's question, which is that although it doesn't, as far as we know, remain a spoken language after a fairly early period, it does remain a chanted language through to the present. And it's frequently on the basis of its chanting that it is committed to text, you know. So it's a very special sort of. I don't know that it's unique, but it's a it's a very specific and special history that and through which it comes to us. I think that
what
was
a nice transition.
Yeah, stimulating question, and back to you, Kim.
Yeah, I love that. David brought it back to the idea of chanting, which is one of the ways that these have been preserved orally over the years. As you read the texts, you can see some elements of chanting in them. They have repeated sections. They have ways in which, you know, sort of cues that would make them easier to memorize and recite in the chanting form, but also work quite nicely on our minds in kind of a meditative, repetitive sense. So what I wanted to play, it's about 3 minutes. I'm going to play the first 3 minutes and 45 seconds of a chant. It's much longer because it's the chant of the whole MN 118, the one that we've been looking at today. So I'm going to play just the beginning of it. And it begins first with, you'll recognize the three homages to the Buddha, and then it goes into the chant. And we're only going to hear really the first few paragraphs of the chant. So hang on while I get that up.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Ivaṃ me sutaṃ ekaṃ samayaṃ bhagavā sāvattiyaṃ viharati pumbārāme miṅgāra mātu pāsādi. Sambhavlehi abhinyatehi abhinyatehi terehi savakihi sandhin. Ayasmatacha sariputtena ayasmatacha mahamongallanena. Ayasmatacha mahakassapena ayasmatacha mahakacchayanena. Ayasmatacha mahakontikena ayasmatacha mahakampinena. Ayasmatacha mahachundena ayasmatacha anurundena. Ayasmatacha revatena ayasmatacha anandena. Anyehi cha abhinyatehi abhinyatehi terehi savakehi sandhin. Tena kopana samayena tera bhinku navi bhinku ovadanti anusasanti. Appi kacche tera bhinku dasapi bhinku ovadanti anusasanti. Ampi kacche tera bhinku visampi bhinku ovadanti anusasanti. Ampi kacche tera bhinku tisampi bhinku ovadanti anusasanti. Ampi kacche tera bhinku chattari sampi bhinku ovadanti anusasanti. Techa nava bhinku terehi bhinkuhi ovadiya mana anusasiya mana. Ularang pumbina parang visesang jananti. Tena kopana samayena bhagava tadupposate pannarase pavaranaya. Punnaya punnamaya rattiya bhikkhu sangha parivruto abhokase nisinno hoti. Atako bhagava tunhi bhutang punhi bhutang bhikkhu sangham anuvilokitva bhikkhu amantesi. Araddhosmi bhikkhave imaya patipadaya. Araddha chintosmi bhikkhave imaya patipadaya. Tasmatiha bhikkhave bhiyo somattaya viriyam arabhat. Appattassa pantiya anadigatassa adigamaya. Asacchikatassa sacchikiriyaya.
Thank you, Ken. So maybe I'll just say just a few more words. It's a little bit, when we're thinking about Pali and translation and script and stuff, here's one way to imagine it. That let's say there's somebody who is chanting just exactly like we heard, and there was an English speaker in audience, there was a Thai speaker in audience, there was a Burmese speaker in audience, and all of them were writing down the sounds of what they heard. So the Burmese people would write it and using their Burmese alphabet, the Thai person would use the Thai alphabet, the English person would use the English alphabet. So that's all. And that's how it happened, right? It started with words, it started with sounds that then got written down. So the pronunciation of Pali, once you know the rules, is easy because they never vary from the rules, right? Because it all came from the sound and was written down. So there's no, unlike English where we have some words that we don't know how to pronounce by how they're written. It's the different in Pali. So maybe I'll just say that. And then I will add that Kim talked about in 1954 was this council to go through the Pali canon. For me, I'm like so impressed by this. One of the rules, in order for Burma, of the different Buddhist countries, how did Burma get chosen to hold the council? It's because in Burma, there were some monastics that had memorized like all the Nikayas, all of that, right? It's just like amazing to think about. I think there was a different one for the Nikayas, different one for the Abhidhamma, and different one for the Vinaya. It's quite astounding, right? To think that even in modern times, there are people who chant just like what we heard and who have memorized, you know, this is probably a lifetime's worth of work probably to do nothing but memorize 100,000 pages of Pali or something like this.
Just a little comment. My understanding was that 1954 council, it took 2 years to finish, and they ended on the full moon in 1956. That was exactly something like 2,500 years after the first council. So anyway.
Yeah, right. I love this kind of tidbit, right? Sometimes when we think about the Pali canon, it feels stiff and staid and something like this, but it's definitely alive. And somebody put in the chat box that that was divine, kind of listening to that. So something that the four of us have discovered, and maybe each one of us would describe it a little bit differently, but, and maybe you have your own experience of this too, but there's a way in which we read the text and for the meaning and the content and the explanation and for us to have a better understanding. Fantastic, excellent. And often we find there's something else being transmitted that maybe isn't, we don't have the exact words for, or something maybe a little bit more than just the exact knowledge. And I'll say for me as a practitioner, right? I'm a PhD scientist. Actually, all of us are here, the four of us. And so that there's, I just want to offer this as a possibility to be open to both types of transmission, a knowledge and something else that I don't myself have exact ways to point to, but that touches me and supports me and, I don't know, makes me happy in some kind of way. So I just wanted to share that. So sometimes when we teach these classes, we have homework, and we don't have specific homework, but I do want to say, for those of you who do have a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya, to go ahead and look at the table of contents, and you'll see what I was talking about, the way that it's organized, that it has the first 50, and then it has there's five chapters, and then within the chapters or the different suttas. We so rarely talk about this, but it's recognized. And then we'll build on that next Saturday. We'll talk some more about that and like why that's relevant or something like that. Maybe one last thing as we close here. We will be sending you an email that has the slides that I did and that Kim did and the link to this chant that Kim just shared with us. And maybe I'll end there. Maybe I'll just end there. And as an invitation to you, it's so great to share this with you all and kind of explore this together and to enter into this world of the Pali Canon, and we look forward to seeing you next Saturday. And I don't know, do any of my co-teachers here, do you have some last words you'd like to say? No, I'm looking for Ying. Where's Ying? She's over here.
There she is.
Okay, so that's
well. Take care, everybody.
Mute, and we can all say goodbye. And
bye bye.
And Ruli Wei, we can just all speak at the same time. So bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Dream Team.
Gracias.
Next week.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Don't want to